Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. I welcome people from all over the world and all the different stations that carry this program. Today, we're going to talk, as we always do, about health and healing. And we're going to look at what happens when women work too many hours. Now, that includes any type of work. So imagine all the homemakers who spend a lot of time really putting in the hours when it comes to their children. That's also considered a part of this, so I'm going to give you the news on that. Also today, we've always assumed that Alzheimer's was a disease of aging. And we will look at the brain of a person with Alzheimer's, and you'll see these little streaks in the brain. Those are called amyloid plaques. Inflammation causes those. So the more inflammation that you have, the more plaques you have, the more susceptible you are to dementia and Alzheimer's. Not true. Wait to hear something new today that should really make everyone pay attention to what they're doing. Also today, how walnuts alter your gut microbiome for the best, University of Connecticut. And from the University of Michigan, how whole natural fibers work best protect your gut mucosal layer. What does that mean? Can't you just walk into any drugstore and get some fiber, liquid fiber in the bottle? Yeah, you can. Doesn't work the same, though. Not according to this study. So those of you who have been getting your fiber the old-fashioned way, by a whole grain diet, whole food diet, you're doing it right. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program is Professor Mark Danner. Professor Danner is a renowned journalist and educator. In fact, he's currently the Chancellor's Professor of Journalism English, University of California, Berkeley. And we're going to talk about the myth of American exceptionalism and the adverse consequences of its endless war on terror. Because that's all anyone's talking about. If you watch Bill O'Reilly, you will see him just keep pounding the drum that we need boots on the ground, we have to go into these countries. What about sovereign nation status? Where were we invited into Libya, a sovereign nation? Into Syria, a sovereign nation? We haven't been invited. Do we presume that we can go into any nation in the world at any time for any reason if we feel it's in our interest? We'll have that discussion, long overdue. Also exposed today, the pesticide industry deployed aggressive lobbying efforts to quash bee protections. That's from Common Dreams. Why? Because I challenge Bayer, I challenge Monsanto, and I challenge Syngenta. An open invitation. Please bring your best, most qualified, articulate scientists, and you have many, on this program to debate me, no one else, on the question of the safety of your pesticides and how they cause massive death of bees, and how you, each of your companies, engage lobbyists to keep that information from changing so that the protection was for you and your product, not the poor bees, the beekeeper, or one-third of all the pollination that occurs, meaning one-third of everything we eat has to have bees pollinating, or we have problems. So, you have an invitation to debate me. And I hope the people in this audience ask Monsanto. Gary Knowles asked for debate, just him. Send one or two or three people on, and let's have that debate. Let's see what the public thinks when they see the facts. We're going to start by talking about walnuts. Now, all nuts are very healthy, but there are some that are a little better than others. And the walnut is at the top of that list. Pistachio is right behind it, by the way, and macadamias as well. This is from the University of Connecticut, published in Cancer Prevention Research. Quote, eating walnuts may change your gut bacteria in a way that suppresses colon cancer. Team of researchers at the Jackson Laboratory for Genomic Medicine found this out, that you can have a big difference by having these walnuts on colon cancer. That means that the walnut must have two things going for it. Special oils, that are anti-carcinogenic and phytonutrients that are anti-carcinogenic. Because if you look at the fiber in walnuts and compared it to millet or amaranth or whole wheat or beans, it's going to be pretty much the same. So it's not the fiber. And if you look at the protein in there, it's not going to be a whole lot different than protein from pinto beans, for example, or sesame seeds. So it's not the protein. So it's the oils and the phytonutrients. Now, each plant on Earth contains numerous phytoplant nutrients. Those are meant to protect and nourish the plant, more often than protection. Like some of your very bitter plants are bitter because it prevents insects from eating them. And that's why, for example, I always suggest that you make up a really good spray from shallots, onion, and garlic with cayenne pepper. You dilute it about 100 to 1, meaning 100 parts water to 1 part garlic, onion, cayenne, and shallots. You shake it up, and then you spray not just the leaves under and over, but the ground around it. And those oils will stay there, those essential oils, for at least a week. Insects come up to it, don't like it, and they don't bother it. That's why doing it right, you have almost no loss. So here's the bottom line. Each day, take just a handful of walnuts, and you can help prevent one of the really bad cancers, colon cancer. And also, you're helping your heart. There's lots of studies done at Loma Linda University Medical School on the protection of your heart from nuts. You can reduce your risk of heart disease substantially, but it's each day. And as far as the oils go, some people are really into almond oil, walnut oil, avocado oil. Those are all good oils. Here's my suggestion. They also oxidize very rapidly. So when you buy those oils, put them in your refrigerator. If you do, not a problem. You can keep them there, still be fresh, all their nutrient intact for at least 6 months. On a counter top, about 2 months. And by the way, never keep anything in your freezer for more than a year. I don't care what it is. Throw it away. Try to use everything in your freezer within a reasonable period of time. Why? Because freezing will slow down, but it does not stop the genesis of the plant from evolving, the enzymes from evolving, the bacteria from growing. Even ice cream can double in its bacterial content within a month of being in a refrigerator. So just a little, you know, just a little note. And also, when you're having your lemon juice in the morning, always dilute it, and always have an understanding that it's killing bacteria. It's great for blood pressure. It's great for your stomach. It alkalizes the blood. It can help reduce pain. It can flush lactic acid out of the musculature and around the joints, relieving pain from arthritis in the muscles from your tightness of exercising, and you get that pain, you get the burn, even power walking in your shins. Well, that's a lactic acid buildup, and lemon juice helps, along with ginger juice, to flush that out. The ideal juice in the morning on an empty stomach would be the juice of 2 lemons. You could have more, but 2. And the juice of about 2 inches of ginger. The juice of about 4 green apples. And then you could have the rest celery or cucumber, but about 16 ounces. After you drink that, just brush your teeth, right? And that helps deacidify the gum and teeth and protecting your teeth. Now, a study from the University of Michigan shows that dietary fiber plays an important role in protecting your gut's mucosal layer. And this is what it says, quote, "It has long been known that the gut stays healthier and performs better with adequate fiber. But why?" This is one of the questions that informed the research conducted by Dr. Eric Martens, professor of microbiology and immunology, University of Michigan. And they presented at the World Congress on this, and they found that the probiota, pro, P-R-O, biota, B-I-O-T-A, is built and strengthened when you have prebiotics and probiotics. And so that's why it protects your mucosal membrane, and that's what you want. And there are a lot of things that will protect your mucosal lining, and you want to get those probiotics daily. How many? On the low end, a billion. On the high end, it could go to 100 billion. If I'm working with someone who has, let's say, Crohn's disease or ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, diverticulitis, ulcers within the colon, intestines, or stomach, Helicobacter, E. pylori, the bacterium in the stomach that can lead to stomach cancer, I might suggest 20, 30 billion, 2 or 3 times a day to really build that up. And then other nutrients, of course, that are important for that and that help to turn off inflammation and to build new tissue and to create an enormous amount of good bacteria in the gut. I cannot emphasize enough how important to your health and longevity and disease prevention good bacteria are. And by the way, do you know a great probiotic that we never talk about? Walnuts again. That's right. Walnuts are rich in a polyunsaturated fatty acids that we know, and the omega-3 and the omega-6 fatty acids, and also vitamin E. And vitamin E is an anti-cancer nutrient. But walnuts are not merely the sum of their chemical parts, and it's also when they digest, and when they're digesting, and the breakdown products end up giving you some probiotics. So that's good also, one more reason to use them. Also, there are what are called tocotrienols. Now you have two types of nutrients. One are tocopherols, that would be your mixed alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and from natural sources, that's your vitamin E. And vitamin E is extremely important. I believe that people should take vitamin E before they work out, after they work out, before they go to bed. Remember, the majority of heart attack and strokes occur about mid-morning, like 3 o'clock in the morning. So if you take natural nutrients that thin your blood, oxygenate your blood, protect your heart, feed the mitochondria in your heart, and help relax the heart muscle during the sleep period, you're preventing a heart attack or stroke at night. What would those be? Vitamin E would be right up the top of the list, coenzyme Q10, generally between 200 to 400 units with each one, and with also cayenne, high heat unit cayenne thins the blood, magnesium, both from magnesium oxide and magnesium citrate, and also very good would be hawthorn. Hawthorn is just the best single herb you can take for your heart. Right behind hawthorn, if you have your regular heartbeat, tachycardia, arrhythmias, AFib, would be a ginkgo biloba herb, 100, 200 milligrams, just to keep you healthier before, after your workout, and while you sleep. Now, the tocotrienols are a subfraction of the vitamin E, and people just never thought that they were important. But according to Georgia State University, they are very important. And why? Because they can prevent Alzheimer's. That's right. Investigators published a report in Dementia and Mental Illness, the peer-reviewed journal, and they found that, quote, currently there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease. Clinical trials are underway to reduce amyloid generation and deposition and neuropathological hallmarks in brains and of the patients. And then they talk about what they found when they used the tocotrienols. And the article concludes, quote, tocotrienol-containing plant foods and tocotrienol derivatives and formulations with enhanced bioavailability may offer a novel approach in Alzheimer's disease prevention and treatment. That's terrific. And by the way, one more thing from Purdue University. Vitamin E inhibits pro-inflammatory enzymes and induces programmed cell death of human cancer cells. So vitamin E can help the body kill cancer cells. How about that? All good. And finally, two things. If women are working long hours, according to this research from Ohio State University, published in the Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine, you're more likely to have cancer and heart disease. Quote, women who put in long hours for the bulk of their careers may pay a steep price, life-threatening illnesses including heart attack and cancer. Work weeks that average 60 hours or more over 3 decades appear to triple the risk of diabetes, cancer, and heart troubles and arthritis for women. And the risks begin to climb when women put in more than 40 hours of work a week. Now, mind you, that's really important because we didn't know that. But that could be any form of work, including homework, working at home, an artist working on their project, people who are impassioned by their work. So you have to separate out the fact that you may love your work from what it's doing when you don't take those breaks. You don't give yourself that respite. You can be killing yourself. And lastly today, and I say this for last, I work with a lot of people who have brain problems. And it generally starts with forgetfulness in their 40s and really accelerates in their 50s, and they're having a hard time. They can work around it. They won't remember someone's name. Oh, hi, how's it going? They won't remember the book title or chapter they just read. Won't remember names of movies. They forget things. And then it just advances from there. And it's bad to see, but once you see the symptoms, you've got to interdict immediately. It was 12 years ago that a very, very close friend of mine, for the whole time I've been in New York, began to show this. And at dinner one night, I said, give yourself a break. I'm going down to my home. I'm going to be doing a lot of research and writing. I'm writing a new book. I need to be quiet. I need no one around me. I need just privacy. But I want you there. And I'll put you on a protocol. You can do all the work you normally do, but at least I can help you. Okay, great idea. Didn't do it. Always something else. And this went on for about 3 years. And then it goes to an advanced stage where, hey, Gary, want to have dinner? Yeah. We haven't had dinner in a long time. Isn't the time we had dinner together? Sure. You realize we had dinner last night and 2 days ago and a day before that. Did you forget that? No, we didn't. Yeah, we did. Well, can I come by your office and see you? No, I'm 10 o'clock. You've been coming by my office every day at 10 o'clock for the past 2 years. I give you protocols. You don't take them. Then you forget to take them, then you will forget you're there. You're wealthy enough to hire someone as an assistant to make you special beverages, so you make sure that you get this each day. Okay, never did it once. Now, my friend, it's too late. You wouldn't know it because, oh, hi, how you doing? Can't carry on a conversation. So now they have to have someone with them because they're very famous and no one knows it. But it's just so sad. So when I tell you, when you see someone, especially someone you know, someone who's close to you, when you see them beginning to forget things, don't assume that it's not that important. It is leading somewhere. And where it's leading is a deep, dark, slippery slope they will not be able to help. Now, can we help them? Yes, but I have to have them in a controlled environment to do it. And when I have, we've reversed Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. Someday I'll tell you about my conversations with the Muhammad Ali people. He chose not to do the protocol. That was unfortunate. Had he, I believe he'd be alive today and healthy with full recovery. But that's another discussion. It doesn't mean because someone asks for help that they're willing to use it when they find out how much they got to change. That's the issue. Can we help people? We can help people with everything. But do they really want to change and give it all up if it's bad, to do it all right? No, most don't. Here's the latest news why you should pay careful attention. Quote, it isn't just an older person's disease. That's a sobering reality about the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. While Alzheimer's disease typically strikes patients around the 60s, and we have over 5 million minimally diagnosed, and we have another 5-10 million who are in process of that. That shocking truth hit home for a Detroit area couple, Ken and Nikki, when doctors diagnosed Ken with Alzheimer's disease just a week shy of his 30th birthday. He's 29 years old, quote, diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, given only a few years to live, at 29 years of age. So, here's the new reality. You're hearing it for the first time anywhere today. Based upon how many pro-inflammatory factors we bring into our life on a daily basis, it has accelerated the speed of the aging of the brain. We have binge drinking in college. We have high-level social drinking. Destroys the brain. We have fast foods. Destroys the brain. Fried food destroys the brain. Coffee destroys the brain. Sugars destroy the brain. In fact, much of what we consume daily destroys the brain. We have a lot of contaminants in our home and work environment. Inflammation. We are under stress, many people more than they've ever been in their life. Destroys the brain because stress creates cortisol rushes, and cortisol rushes destroy the brain. Elevated blood sugar. We have more Americans, adults, who are diabetic and pre-diabetic than any other nation in the world per population. In fact, let me tell you how bad it is. We have more pre-diabetic and diabetics as a percent of our population than India and China combined. Where are you, Surgeon General, President of the United States, members of Congress, the media, the manufacturers? Where are you? Either living in denial of it or not willing to take on the people who are causing it. Because this isn't natural. Can we reverse it? Yes. It's easy to reverse diabetes. It's easy. But you have to commit yourself to it. So, with diabetes, you're already on your way to Alzheimer's disease. Because what affects the blood sugar, when that blood sugar rises after your spike from the sugar in a meal, it goes to your brain. And you have inflammation in the brain. Just want to share that with you. Let you know that now we're going to start to see a whole lot of young people in their 20s and 30s with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. I'm telling you now, ahead of the curve. Remember, it was 10 years ago I told you we're going to see an epidemic, a pandemic of brain conditions because of cell phones? Well, we're there now, and it's only going to get worse. So just about everything humanly possible we could do wrong at every level, we're doing it right now, except for those 5%, which is still a lot of people. That's still about 18 million people are doing a lot right. Let's hope more people get the message. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world from our environmental segment today. Good news. And that is, they're finally being exposed. Bayer, Monsanto, and Syngenta, according to Common Dreams, quote, are effectively shaping new pollinator protection plans nationwide that do little to protect bees, but a lot to protect industry profits. despite the abundance of scientific studies documenting the rapid and dangerous decline of pollinator populations, state and federal lawmakers have yet to pass any meaningful protection for bees. The reason, according to the findings of a new investigation, is that pesticide giants such as Bayer, Monsanto, and Syngenta have deployed an aggressive lobbying campaign to dilute and suppress attempts to regulate their multi-billion-dollar industry, and they're doing it with great success. Published by environmental watchdog Friends of the Earth, the report exposes, quote, how the pesticide industry has weakened and delayed pesticide reform and is shaping new pollinator protection plans nationwide that do little to protect bees, but a lot to protect industry profits. They're spending an enormous amount of money lobbying state and federal officials so that they protect the people who are polluting, not the bees. Brazil has now refused all imports of GM-grown food from the United States from the Natural Blaze. Quote, the list of countries refusing Monsanto's genetically modified crops continues to grow, highlighting the world divide on the issue. Brazil recently refused all U.S.-grown genetically modified crops. That is terrific, and they should be commended for that because they seem to care a whole lot more about their citizens' health than our government officials that still allow it in the United States. And also, there's new research that shows that epilepsy can be treated successfully with cannabis, the cannabinoid oils. And where did we find this out? It actually started as a study in 1940s. The government hid this information. For all these years, they've known that treating children with their seizures can be successful, and the government hid it. So it's been uncovered now. So if you have a doctor that can help your child with that seizures, do it. And also another good thing, the people who've been deforesting lots of Borneo and the Southeast Asian islands by growing palm oil plants to harvest them for all these foods, French fries or potato chips, well, it's not going so well for them right now. According to Greenpeace International, Anisha Ramawadi, quote, one of the largest palm oil companies in the world is having a difficult time right now. Not only has it recently lost its sustainability certification, but as a result, its customers are leaving in droves, and with good reason. A new report from Greenpeace International shows how IOI's operations have led to the destruction of forest and peatlands in Borneo despite repeated promises to protect these areas. And since the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil withdrew IOI's sustainability certification in March, its share price has tanked and its credit ratings have been placed under review. Most damning of all, every one of the major brands featured in our recent palm oil scorecard that was buying palm oil from IOI is in the process of canceling their contracts. The most recent of these is General Mills, which after receiving tens of thousands of emails from Greenpeace supporters announced last week that it will be phasing out its purchase of IOI's palm oil. So, you see, your letters, your protests do matter. Your threat to boycott products that are corrupted, that are unhealthy, do matter. So good. That's all good on that level. We're going to go to our guest, who is standing by in Berkeley, California. He is Professor Mark Danner, D-A-N-N-E-R. He's a very respected journalist, educator. He's covered overseas wars and American foreign policy for over 30 years. He's currently the Chancellor's Professor of Journalism and English at the University of California at Berkeley and the James Clark Chase Professor of Foreign Affairs at Bard College, specializing in American militarism, the war on terror, torture, and U.S. foreign policy. In the past, he's been on the staff of The New Yorker, Harper's, and The New York Review of Books, and he's covered conflicts in the East and Haiti, in Central America, in the Balkans, in Iraq, and he's been featured on Bill Moyers and Charlie Rose, and he is the author of Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War, which explores how the nation has changed dramatically since 9/11. His website is markdanner.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's good to be with you.
After 9/11, there was a series of legislative moves that opened the door for the U.S. to advance a global military hegemony around the planet. And at first, these acts, such as the authorization for use of military force, signed only days after 9/11, were focused solely on nations or organizations that the Bush administration deemed as responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Now, 15 years later, those original bills and acts have expanded well beyond those accused of these acts in 9/11. They can now apply to any country the U.S. wants to challenge, who may have some belligerence towards us or not. And the original war on terror was simply in response to 9/11. It isn't any longer. Now it has become almost a way of life in our culture and a propaganda tool for the keeping the U.S. in a high adrenaline state of fear of terrorism. So I'd like you, if you would please, to begin by examining the salient bills and acts and actions during the Bush presidency that anchored the war on terror into both our domestic and foreign policy, and then give us some examples of how some of these actions have now expanded, perhaps out of control or taken a life of their own, that now keeps the U.S. in a downward no-win spiral, which consumes a tremendous amount of our money and our tax dollars, and the U.S. military and intelligence agency are virtually unaccountable to anyone today. And also look at all the private corporate sector, thousands upon tens of thousands of corporations, and the media. And all of this is impacting the soul of our citizenry. So take us through Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Clinton, and Obama, and what is the likely outcome if we do not change course. The forum is yours.
That's a big question. In the days after September 11th attacks, the Congress passed, and President Bush signed, an authorization for the use of military force. Now, this was limited to the organizations and groups that had struck the United States on September 11th. A year later, the Congress passed another authorization for the use of military force that applied more specifically to Iraq, to the Iraq invasion and occupation. But these two instruments have essentially been, as you said, expanded during the course of the last 15 years, so that the United States is currently engaged in hostilities, of course, in Iraq, in Syria, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Libya, in Somalia. One could name a number of other places that are kind of coming onto the list now, but the United States is engaged in hostilities in those places using special operations forces, paramilitary forces of the CIA, military special operators, and also, of course, unmanned aerial vehicles, commonly known as drones. During the Obama administration, perhaps 5,000 people have been killed using drones, primarily in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Yemen. Somalia also. So what was originally intended to be a relatively narrow hostility directed specifically by the Congress against those who had attacked the United States has expanded into a worldwide, unbounded in space, unbounded in time, military conflict, which shows no sign whatever of ending. It also, it should be said, is self-perpetuating. And by which I mean that we are killing people. This is, I think, understandably not very popular in certain places. You know, when we look at people in this country who lately have been attacking, doing these attacks in the name of the Islamic State, we say, well, they radicalized. This person radicalized. We don't really understand that process. And I would say that there's nothing terribly mysterious about this process. It's usually people very upset at the killing of Muslims. You know, very often these people are disturbed in one way or another. They're outliers. They're solitary figures. But the radicalization process isn't, I think, that really obscure on its face. It has to do with the U.S.'s broader policy in the Middle East and in the Islamic world more generally. I think what I would like to emphasize, and the point that Spiral sets out to make, is that we see no sign of ending this war, and indeed we've created a kind of perpetual motion machine. We keep striking and killing, they respond, and the strategy we've adopted shows no sign of ending the war. Indeed, if you look at the situation on the day after September 11th, you had a group called Al-Qaeda, which had perhaps a couple thousand of adherents, probably fewer than that, spread around the mountains of Afghanistan. If you look now, you have not only Al-Qaeda still existing, but another transnational, worldwide terror organization, the Islamic State, which holds the territory the size of Great Britain on both sides of the Syria-Iraq border, has perhaps 30 to 40,000 adherents, thousands of foreign fighters, and has franchises all over the world. There are scores of jihadi groups. In the year after September 11th, there were 729 terrorist attacks, according to the State Department. Last year, there were 33,000. So the number of attacks has increased by approximately 4,000 percent during the war on terror. I think any objective analysis would suggest that the actions that the United States has taken have been counterproductive in the extreme. So the first thing I set out to do in Spiral is to prove that point conclusively, and I think I do prove it conclusively. You've asked what we can do, and I think I set out a plea for a much narrower effort against terrorism that's directed specifically at people who are planning to do Americans harm, and a much more modest policy within the Middle East that doesn't attempt to overthrow states, that doesn't attempt to remake countries. I think that our policy within the Middle East is neo-imperial policy that's really out of date. It doesn't conform to the needs in today's world. There are now wars going on in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, and I think the United States cannot determine the outcomes of these wars, and when the United States has tried to do it, usually we have harmed our vital interests, as in Iraq and in Libya. So I argue for a much more modest foreign policy for the United States, particularly in the Middle East.
Let us set aside any concept that it requires an in-depth understanding of foreign policy per nation, plus the integration of trading and cultures, ethnicity groups within a given area. The difference between a Persian, if you ask the average American, what is a Persian, what is a non-Persian in a given area, they wouldn't know. But everyone has common sense. So let's just look at common sense as a factor. If we are causing the displacement of millions of individuals in Iraq, which is a fact that no one disputes, and also in Libya. In fact, many of the people who have died, 700 to 900 just in 1 week in tragic accidents getting from North Africa into other countries, their boats capsized, but all the ones who did make it, and they have no place to go except some form of refugee camp. And then there is the conflict between the locals who frequently don't want them and those who have no place else to go. Well, we caused that. These people wouldn't be migrating there. In Libya, they had one of the highest standards of living, the highest standard of living in Africa. Now look at Libya. And yet Hillary Clinton's running on a policy that look what I did in Libya. And she actually laughed. It was cackling on a program. You know, we came, we saw he died. Well, why doesn't she put up a photo of how he died in his last minutes, showing him being sodomized and with a sword and all the other ways that he was tortured? When did you prove your case, I would ask, to these people that we had the right to invade a sovereign country? We could disagree with them. We could embargo them. But since when do we have a right to go into a country to create havoc? And the very thing that we say we fear, the growth of Islamic State or some form of al-Nusra or al-Qaeda, we then create the perfect breeding ground for it in Libya and in some areas of Syria and in parts of Iraq. and in the sectarian conflict. And then you have the people who have no place to go, have to either they have to find a place in their own country or go to another country, or then all the people who are exposed to depleted uranium end up with all kinds of diseases, like Agent Orange in Vietnam, or they end up dead or some way injured. And now take a family. In the Middle East, the average size of an extended family is 41 people. Now, let's say that a drone killed some of those people, or one of those people was tortured. How supportive are they going to be of wanting to appreciate the United States and its citizens? The average citizen certainly is not a person that you would be against if you knew the average person. But they're not knowing the average person. They're just knowing the extent of our policies. So common sense says, take a look at the total number of people that we have adversely affected, and then ask, does that provide for conciliation, a cooperation in the future, or does it offer a place where people can easily become a terrorist and have their supporters? That has just common sense alone is how I would look at it before anything else, and I don't see any of that used in the talking heads on Fox or MSNBC or the other networks. Your thoughts on that, please?
Well, I agree with just about everything you just said. I think that the United States, certainly since the Second World War, has become used to understanding its power as military power. And I think this has tendency has increased since the end of the Cold War in 1989. The United States saw itself for the first time as simply the preeminent military power in the world. And I think after the September 11th attacks, there was great interest, particularly on the Republican side, about using that military power. In other words, if the phrase is, if you have a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail. And indeed, we have the biggest hammer in the world. So we used our military force, first in Afghanistan, but then especially in an occupation, a very misbegotten occupation of Iraq. And it should be said that these attacks, you know, people, I think, don't ask the basic question frequently enough: what was al-Qaeda trying to achieve in attacking the United States on September 11, 2001? And beyond killing a lot of people, they wanted to provoke the United States to send its troops into Muslim countries. I mean, this is not some kind of conspiracy theory. It's, you know, in the documents. This is what they counted on. They were trying to build a movement by having U.S. troops on the ground, which would provoke a movement against them among Muslims, particularly Sunni Muslims. And the United States not only complied in Afghanistan, it complied, much to the surprise of al-Qaeda, by invading and occupying Iraq and creating an occupation that was highly telegenic. You know, it showed every day American troops smashing their way into Muslim houses, throwing Muslims on the ground, putting their boots on their backs, torturing them in Abu Ghraib prison. And all of these things were enormously successful in creating a jihadi movement. They also created the Islamic State of Iraq, which then it morphed into what's now called the Islamic State. I mean, the United States created this group. And again, this is a matter of record. This is not controversial. This began in the early days of the occupation with a combination of Iraqi Islamists and Baathists, former members of Saddam Hussein's security apparatus. And that is what it still is today. The leadership is a mixture of Baathists and Islamists, who grew up and joined one another during the American occupation. So we've essentially repeatedly created our own enemy. I think I'd hasten to add that I don't think that means that there's a simple solution, that there was something simple to do here. But I do think it's striking the way the United States acted against its own best interests, and the way the United States continues to act against its own best interests. You know, you have the rise now of Donald Trump, who wants to, I believe the phrase was, bomb the hell out of ISIS, who's arguing for a much stronger response, not only on the immigration side by not permitting Muslims to enter the country, but on the military side, bombing extensively in Syria and Iraq. which would indeed kill lots more civilians and help the Islamic State. I mean, there's certainly, it would love to have a Donald Trump presidency. There's no question about it, which is one of the reasons I'm apprehensive about there being, in the run-up to the election, not only more attacks, but more attacks that are actually planned for maximum lethality by the Islamic State, because I think they would perceive that those would help Donald Trump in the election campaign.
What do you see as the most reasonable approach to go forward from here?
Well, that's a very good question, because we're very deep in the hole right now. I mean, we've made a lot of terrible mistakes. I think the United States needs to focus its energies on preventing and disrupting attacks by those who actually are trying to do Americans and the United States harm. I think that the entire policy has to be narrowed down, focused on the actual bad actors who are planning to attack the country, not simply on every member of militant groups in South Asia and the Middle East. I think that the role of the United States in the Middle East should be limited. I think the notion that we can direct what's going on there is a misbegotten one, has been demonstrated again and again. I also think it's outdated. You know, our policy is really based on the so-called Carter Doctrine from 1979, I believe, or 1980, I think it was first promulgated, which is all about keeping outside actors from dominating the oil fields of the Middle East. And in fact, the U.S. interest, the U.S., you know, the situation of the United States vis-a-vis oil in the Middle East has changed dramatically. The U.S. no longer needs that oil. It is no longer as vital to the world market. Many other countries are much more dependent on it than we are. So I think it's time to revolutionize that policy and to narrow our concerns into simply a matter of protecting, insofar as it's possible, the American people. I think there should be, you know, the bill that's being suggested now about, I mean, it just sounds almost absurd to say it, but the great controversy of the moment in the United States is, should we keep people on the terrorist watch list from buying assault weapons, which just seems like some science fiction satire. But obviously we should do that. There should be much more effort made at, in the country itself in trying to prevent bad actors from obtaining lethal weapons, obviously. And I think we also have to tell ourselves that we're not going to stop all terrorist attacks. In fact, since 9/11, you know, the number of people killed by terrorism is actually quite low. Only in the last year, with the Orlando and San Bernardino attacks, have you had substantial attacks on American territory. So I think we have to redouble that effort, and we also have to tell people that these things are going to happen sometimes. You can't prevent all of them, particularly in a country where guns and to some extent explosives are very easy to obtain. But we shouldn't devote our entire foreign policy to it, and we shouldn't make things worse, which is what we've been almost uniformly doing since September 11th.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you very much, Professor Mark Dannon. And the new book is called Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. His website is markdanner.com. Appreciate you being on with us today.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a really powerful show tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
Being here with you, being near with you. me know if the love is really real, but it seems to me.